all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Jeffrey S. Copeland, a professor at University of Northern Iowa. Jeff, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me on. It's an honor.
Well, we've got an interesting story to tell. Whenever you can tell stories about nurses and medevac, actually the first medevac, I think this is a story nobody's ever heard of. But before we get there, let's talk a little bit about you. You have a PhD in from the University of Missouri at Columbia. You find yourself as a professor of, is it of English at University of Northern Iowa?
Yes, it is.
And you are a prolific author and editor of over 30 books. We're going to talk about one of them today. You are, as I say, sort of a prolific writer. What motivates you to do all that?
Well, actually, this started when I was a little boy. My grandmother was the best storyteller I have ever heard in my life. I mean, she would put Mark Twain to shame, literally. But she used to tell me stories all the time as a kid. And as I got older, I started writing my own stories. But I was really interested in the nonfiction. With my grandmother, a lot of it was clearly just made up to entertain, you know, my siblings and myself. But I was interested in stories from the get-go. So through the years, I found out that I just was very blessed with an ability to write. And I love it. I dearly love doing the research in particular. And it takes me about a year to do the background research for my books now, and then about 6 months to actually write them, because I want to make sure I have all the facts and everything correct as I do it. And that was the case with the book we're talking about now, Lieutenant Elsiot's Top Secret Mission. How I got into that one was I started thinking about the early women pioneers in aviation, did a little bit of research, discovered several that were quite interesting to me. But one name kept popping up in every single thing I read, and it was Lieutenant Elsiot. And I thought, you know, why is this person in everything? And then I finally one afternoon found out she was also the first woman ever to receive the Army Air Medal. And I thought, wow, this is really something. At that same time, just by chance, I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, one of my favorite places to visit, going through one of their exhibits there. And lo and behold, there's a special exhibit just on Lieutenant Ott. And I thought, now, wait a minute here. I've got to dig. So, Jim, you'll love this. Okay, I started my research process, but every place I went to get my military records, everything was still closed and labeled top secret. Well, to me, as a writer and somebody who's naturally curious, that fanned the fires even more. I had to find out about this individual. So I did. I just decided I'm going to uncover this story because obviously there's more here. And wow, I had no idea what I was going to discover.
Well, when you have these kind of untold stories, Jeff, how do you get enough research material to pull together to actually, you know, spend that year getting what you need so you can write the book, Lieutenant Elsiot's Top Secret Mission, subtitled The Pioneer World War II Flight Nurse Behind Aerial Medical Evacuation, or MEDEVAC? How do you get the research?
Okay, so you have to be a bulldog, and you have to be willing to keep going when people tell you no. So I literally went everywhere. Maxwell Air Force Base was a good source of information. Fort Sam Houston, the archives there are still open. That was a wonderful source. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was as well. And then there's this wonderful organization I'm sure you know about called Legends of Flight Nurses. It's a national organization devoted to preserving the history of what flight nurses did during World War II, Korea, and in the Vietnam War. So I had a lot of general information about her when I did the basic research. But in order to dig deeper into this, I needed to find relatives. And I was lucky enough to find some of her relatives. I was lucky enough to find some other flight nurses who had served at the same time, and then went through the back door. As I did my research, I discovered it was because of what Lieutenant Elsiot did that the flight nurse program was initiated during World War II at Bowman Field in Kentucky. And through their records, I was able to go backward from there and get all the way back to Major General David Grant during World War II, whose idea medevac actually was. It was actually his idea. So when you're ready, have I got a story to tell you about that?
Well, let me back you up a minute, too, because I want to talk about Elsiot as a woman, as a nurse, before she gets on this historic trip. Tell us a little bit about her background, because it's, you know, sometimes you build these people up and you think they're all supermen or superwomen. She came from pretty ordinary nursing school, and tell us about her background.
Well, she did. She was a New Jersey resident. That's where she pretty much grew up, went to high school, did some of her nurse training at Lenox Hill Hospital School of Nursing. That was all before the war, and then went to Kings Park Hospital and got specialized training to deal with very severe injuries and illnesses. And when the war broke out, she decided that in her heart, she really had to help serve and help save as many soldiers as possible. So she signed up. She ended up being sent to the 159th Station Hospital in Karachi, India, which was part of the China-Burma-India Theater. So while she was there and while operations were taking place in Burma, excuse me, and other places in the region, she was responsible for helping take care of the casualties in that region. So she's there. It's basically in the desert. Karachi, India is actually part of Pakistan today. But at the time, they were several miles outside of Karachi. It's where the 159th was. And she was one of the more popular nurses there, one of the more skilled and one of the more gifted. So she was very good at what she did. And one morning, she was called in by her commanding officer. And basically, she was told, all right, I want you to get ready tomorrow morning. You're going to get on an airplane. You're going to take five wounded soldiers. Actually, a sergeant was sent with her. He was the sixth patient. He had rheumatoid arthritis. You're going to take six patients by airplane to get help. And basically, I read all the accounts of this. She said, really? I want you to know I've never been on an airplane before. She got over there by ship. And he said, don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. So I want you to take these individuals to get help. And she thought, well, okay, I can do this. So she asked her CO, so how far am I going? And he said, Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. And she was just floored. She was absolutely stunned.
Well, and nowadays we expect to hear that, right? We've lived through Iraq and Afghanistan wars now for 20 years. And we hear stories all the time where injury on the battlefield and off to Longstuhl, Germany, and then over to Walter Reed all in about 48 hours or something. It's kind of amazing. But this Karachi, India to Washington, D.C. is like 10,000 miles, and it's not an overnight trip, is it?
No, and with the stops that they made, the particular route they took, which we can go through here shortly, it was actually more like 13,000 miles. So what she was being asked to do was to take these wounded soldiers in 6.5 days on a journey that at that time typically took, are you ready for this? 3.5 months by truck, by train, by ship. So she was going to do in 6.5 days what would normally take 3.5 months. And let's not forget here, she had never been on an airplane before. So she had 24 hours to get ready. She wasn't really given much instruction except, this is top secret, I am going to give you a letter that if you get in trouble along the way and you need to pull some weight, you can show the letter, but I'd rather that you not. So she was told this is an experiment. She wasn't told everything about why it was being done, but she knew she had to get ready in 24 hours. The other people didn't know what was going on. It was that secret. And we can talk about why it was secret here in a second. So she got basic medical supplies ready, a ton of aspirin. That was the most powerful medicine she could really find at the time. And then with the help of Sergeant Sam Ragazzi, who was going with her, who had the acute rheumatoid arthritis, they took off. They took off in a Goonie Bird, in a C-47. That was the first part of their trip, was on a C-47.
And how many different planes did they, and how many times did they have to stop to pull this off over 6.5 days?
Okay, what they did, I won't go through the whole list here, but they went from Karachi to Saudi Arabia, through Egypt, through El Fasher in the Egyptian Sudan. They went to Nigeria, and once they got all the way over to Accra in Ghana, that's where they traded the Goonie Bird for a B-24 that had been converted. The bomb base section had been pretty much cleaned out so it could take litters, and they were put on that plane for the rest of the journey to Florida. And once I got to Florida, they jumped back onto a DC-3, not a C-47, a more commercial type airline, and that's what they took the rest of the way to Walter Reed. So they had three different airplanes, but the majority of the trip was actually done on the C-47 for the first half and then the B-24 for the second.
It almost sounds like the planes, trains, and automobiles here. We're going to do this, and we just have to figure out how we pull it off. Why these patients? Why this time?
Very good question. And this was one of the things when I discovered the answer to it, it just blew me away. All right, Major General David Grant was the air surgeon at the time during World War II. The casualties in the China-Burma-India theater were mounting, and they needed, a lot of the wounded need specialized help. But because the road system there was so horrible, because transportation in general in that region was so bad, we were losing a lot of our military personnel simply because they couldn't get good help. Well, General Grant took a look at past history and saw that, there really wasn't a lot done up to that point. During the Civil War and the Franco-Prussian War, they used balloons, literally hot air balloons, to try to transport the wounded. It didn't really work. During World War I, they used Jennies, the plane called the Jenny, but they could strap a couple of guys to the wings of that. Can you imagine how spooky that must have been for those poor wounded soldiers?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's worse.
What's worse? And then in the early part of World War II in North Africa, in that campaign, the Germans actually flew out some of their wounded, but they were treated like cargo, not as patients. They didn't have any medical personnel with them or anything. So General Grant decided, you know what? Our losses are unacceptable. If our people are putting their lives on the line, we have to do something about this. So he called together his council and said, we need one very dramatic event, something that I can pull forward and say, all right, this is actually going to work, because the Army Surgeon General at that time, General McGee, was against using airplanes and helicopters to take wounded out. He didn't think it would work. He really honestly didn't think it would work. So David Grant decides, well, we need a dramatic event. So what he did was, he was the one who actually set this up. He wanted it 6.5 days because he knew people would say, are you kidding me? So to answer your question, here's why they chose those particular patients. They knew they had to have patients who had a reasonable chance of survival by the time they got back to Walter Reed. So they had a Lieutenant Jerome Collins who had polio, and it became much worse where they were over there in India. They had a Private Montague who had been with a convoy that drove over a landmine, and he was temporarily paralyzed below the waist because of that. And he needed some specialized care that they could only get back in the States. They had a Captain Goldman, a dentist, who had TB, coughing up blood and everything else. He needed to get back to the States. They had a Corporal Ernst. He was, well, basically, we would call it battle fatigue today. He was a survivor of a Japanese concentration camp over in that region. And all of his friends had been butchered and killed. And because of that, he was in need of some special help. And then a private, his name was Tony Scalini, who had glaucoma with pressure so bad his eyes could have exploded like grapes. So they were all ill, but they all had a reasonable chance of survival if they could actually make that trip. So they wanted these people, these individuals, because there was a very good chance of them surviving. But at the same time, they wanted to make a statement with it. They all had different medical issues. And if they could show in 6.5 days, a range of patients could make this flight, then good. But here is where the story gets very interesting, Jim. Guess what? The brass decided, all right, we need to do this. This is something that really has to be done given what's happening with our casualties. So they decided if this worked, they would take credit for it. They would fight for it. They would go to the president if needed. They would get it done. If it didn't work and the patients died, they were going to blame it on Lieutenant Ott.
Oh, wow. So, there's a whole lot of enlisted and junior officers listening here on Veterans Radio to Professor Jeff Copeland going, yeah, I've been in that situation before. So so is that why it was top secret? They didn't, if it didn't work, they didn't want the word to get out?
No, that's not the reason why it was top secret. The reason it was top secret is General McGee, who was the Army Surgeon General at that time, he had ordered this not to be done. He just said, no, this is not going to work. When we tried this out in World War I, it was a disaster. The Franco-Prussian War, it was a disaster. You people are just dreaming. So they did it in secret because if it succeeded, General Grant could then go to the president and others and say, guess what? We proved it can be done. So forget about all these naysayers. Let's move forward. And that's exactly what worked. But along the way, and I couldn't believe this, I managed finally, this took me almost a year, I finally managed to track down the actual flight log for this journey and the record kept by Lieutenant Elsie Ott herself. Starting off the trip, her first time aboard plane, the very first day, the engine catches fire. So she's on a plane that's on fire. They manage to land. They go to their next stop. They're at a hospital there, a Sudanese hospital, where they're spending the night before they continue the journey. And local guerrillas bomb the hospital. She's bombed in. She's trapped in rubble in a hospital. Then they stop in Kano to pick up a special passenger we can talk about later, and snipers pin them down. So, I mean, it gets worse as it goes. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up.
Why isn't this a movie? Yeah.
Well, because it has been top secret until I wrote about it. But hopefully this year is the 100th anniversary of the ratifying of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. And a lot of books about important women from the 20th century are getting out there. And I have to tell you, Lieutenant Elsie Ott was one of the most important women of the 20th century. And so I think once her story gets told, a lot more people are going to really realize what a true hero she was. Because think about this logically. every time we see a helicopter taking a patient from hospital to hospital, or a plane taking vital organs somewhere for a transplant, we can actually trace this back to Lieutenant Elsiad's trip and everything that she provided the framework for. We got the flight nurse program out of this. We got, you're not going to believe this, they transported over 100,000 soldiers during World War II after she did this, and only 40 of them didn't make it.
Yeah, those, so they would have otherwise been stuck somewhere with really needing treatment. It's really quite incredible.
It is.
I got to back you up though, because you mentioned the secret letter that she got. She got a letter. She could. What did your research ever allow you to take a look at what it was that they gave her that said, if you get in trouble, use this, but we'd prefer you didn't open it?
Yeah, I did. And basically what it said was, if there are any problems here, you are to immediately call the office of Major General David Grant. And since he was one of the most important people in the CBI theater, you didn't throw that name around lightly. You know, he was the one who's, if he said jump, people said, how high, sir? So she had that, and she only had to use it twice, only twice on the whole trip. One was to get the B-24 when she was getting ready to cross over the ocean. They had to land at Ascension Island, which is roughly halfway from the coast, the African coast, over to South America. So at that point, she needed to get another airplane because the C-47 was just not built to do that kind of transatlantic kind of a journey. She had a little bit of a problem getting a plane there. She pulled out the letter, and that's one of the things that helped her get the second plane. It was going anyway, but this allowed her to say, I'm commandeering this plane, and we're going to take this along. So she did have it as a trump card if she needed it, but in most places, they didn't know why she was there. You know, this was secret. But they knew she had wounded, and the other hospitals, our allies, basically, all across Africa, they were willing to step in and say, you know what, we're going to help you out.
Yeah, that takes just a sort of force of personality to pull that off each time you land and say, I've got five guys, I need some help here. Before we run out of time, I want to talk a little bit about that. When she came back, she makes this trip, and she gets recognized for sort of being the first flight nurse and gets promoted to captain. And what else goes on in her career to recognize this achievement?
Well, the interesting thing about this is she is the first woman to receive the Army Air Medal. There was a special ceremony held at Bowman Field in Kentucky where the flight nurse program was initiated. And I think what's really interesting here is her flight log and how she attended to her wounded on the way back over became the major textbook for that course. So she helped teach it. At that time, a lot of people were worried about the effects of altitude on people with various illnesses and wounds and such. So she could tell pretty much firsthand, look, this is what I did. This worked. This didn't work. This needs to be done. And it was a full range of things, from getting full medical supplies aboard ship to a couple of practical things. Lieutenant Ott said, you know what? I had to wear my military uniform, which basically was a skirt. It doesn't work if you're going to be on this kind of a journey. So it was because of her that women then in the service were allowed to wear pants if they were in something like this. The other thing, and I don't know if you've flown on a C-47 or before, but here's the story. For men, let's say using the facilities is not a problem because there's what's called a relief hole at the back of the ship. Well, that doesn't work for women. So they had to redesign the airplane in order to make it appropriate for the nurses who were going to be on board from then on. So everything from the structure of airplanes to uniforms to medical supplies, she was the agent of change for all of that.
We're talking to Jeff Copeland. who's an author, prolific author, who's written a book called Lieutenant Elsie's Ott's Top Secret Mission, The Pioneer World War II Flight Nurse Behind Medevac. Jeff, where can people get this book and learn more about this pioneering woman?
Well, right now, a lot of bookstores are closing up because of what we have taking place. Amazon.com, Amazon Books is probably the best place to get it right now. With Amazon Prime, of course, there's free shipping, but it's available on at any online bookseller. It's available at all the regular stores, too, but I know a lot of people are not wanting to get out right now. So I guess my recommendation would be to go to Amazon or one of those different sites.
And you've written on military topics before. You've written a soldier's story of life in a colored battalion in World War II, Inman's War. Give us just a small snippet of that to intrigue people to go find that book of yours as well.
Well, I got really lucky with that one. I ended up with 150 letters from a Sergeant Inman Perkins back to an Olivia Merriweather, who was a teacher in St. Louis, Missouri. I bought the letters at a flea market just for fun, just to read them. I didn't know who these people were. And as it turned out, they were both incredibly famous, did wonderful things. Inman Perkins was in one of these segregated battalions. They called them colored battalions during World War II. In his group, the 449th Signal Construction Battalion was actually instrumental in the Battle of Anzio during World War II. And that was the ruse to draw the Germans down into the boot of Italy so that a little thing called D-Day could take place. And the story of what his group went through, you read it and you say, wow, these are really true American heroes. It's a great story of how a group of men came together to provide support for one of the most important battles of World War II. And they did it knowing that many of them just weren't going to come back.
Well, it's a very interesting story. Again, these both are. We want to thank you, Jeff Copeland, for taking some time to talking with us here on Veterans Radio today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much. And hey, listen, to all of our people serving all over the world, God bless you.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.